Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. Our guests today are Adam Bentley and Adam Rafowitz from the band Arch Echo. Here goes. Adam Bentley, Adam Rafowitz, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Hello. Yeah.
Hello. You guys are starting to really get out there. I mean, I've heard about you guys before, obviously. I mean, Adam B, you're on Nail the Mix this month. You've been on the podcast, and I have heard of you guys in the scene, but I feel like lately it's starting to speed up, and I'm sure the Dream Theater tour didn't hurt at all. But you guys have been around for a while, right? How long have you guys been together?
I think it was like November 2017 that we kind of began.
2016.
Was it 2016? Jeez.
Well, we released that first single January 2017.
Right. But yeah, it was like, I think the first ever writing session really took place in like August 2016.
How long did it take before people noticed? Seems like pretty quick, but then it just kind of evened off for a while.
Yeah. The first single did well, like-ish. I mean, better than we expected. I don't know if I'm just speaking for myself there. And then the first album, I thought, again, did way better than we thought. But it was just kind of like, we're just putting stuff out on the internet, you know? We didn't know how it would do. So it was exciting to see that it got traction. And then, yeah, it was just kind of a slow burn, I'd say, after that, just playing tours.
It's weird that instrumental music can do as well as it does these days. Because at least when I grew up, the whole concept of instrumental music was, if you want to have a really shitty career, put out instrumental music. But I feel like that's all changed in the past, like, decade.
Yeah, for sure.
There are a lot of instrumental acts right now definitely doing very well, and we're just kind of trying to get in on that, but have our own thing, you know? I think everybody brings something very different to the band that some of these other acts don't necessarily have. Like, not a lot of keyboardists like Joey Izzo out there. So there's kind of something for everybody, I feel like, whether you're a drummer, keyboardist, guitarist of any style, so, or bassist, of course.
It seems to me like you guys would be kind of considered musicians band, whereas a lot of the instrumental stuff, even though it appeals to a lot of musicians, it's not as hardcore, basically. Speaking of, so both of you went to Berklee?
Yep.
Yeah, we did.
So that makes three of us. I'm so sorry. Condolences. The quality of lead guitar players these days is so high. All I focus on now is writing cool shit, because there's so many players that are just like insane. It didn't used to be this way. There have always been great players, but I guess when my band came out, there really weren't that many great players in the scene. There were a couple. There were a few, but not like, it wasn't like it is now, where there's just great players everywhere. And you just go on Instagram Reels and you find, every time you go on there, you'll find a new virtuoso, which is nuts. Like, back in the day, you had to, like, there were like five people in the entire metal scene who you could consider virtuosos. And like, you know who some of them are, like Petrucci or Loomis or whatever. But like, there's a whole lot of them now. And so what I'm wondering, because you guys are kind of part of that new school, I'm just wondering, where did you guys get your information from on how to practice the right stuff?
A lot of it, like, was listening to players like Holdsworth, like Guthrie Govan and Greg Howe and stuff, and just being like, I want to play like that. Honestly, yeah, as far as like where to practice or the right stuff, it's kind of a complicated question, because it was like any given day, like, what am I working on? You know, am I transcribing a solo? And I will say a place like Berklee kind of helped force me to have to do that, because you'd have like a straight up assignment that's like, all right, transcribe a solo and play it, but it has to be from a horn player. That helped a lot as well. And also, just like my background not being a metal player, and then being kind of thrown into progressive metal when I got at Berklee and discovering it, kind of forced me to have to improve some of my chops and work on different techniques, because I can't alternate pick at all. And I couldn't back then, I can't now. Like, I just can't do it. So I had to kind of be like, okay, what techniques can I use to keep up this speed? So, you know, had to practice some legato, hybrid picking, things like that, to kind of compromise and fake it till you make it, if you will.
You know, it's funny you say that, because we've got Tom Quayle on Riff Hard right now, and one of his opening statements was talking about how he thinks his right hand sucks, and he developed his style as a way to get around that, basically, in that as a guitar player, instead of beating yourself up over the things that you just, for whatever reason, your body just won't do, figure workarounds or figure other ways to achieve the result.
Exactly. That's kind of my MO. Back in the day, like, obviously a lot of us start with classic rock and stuff, so it's kind of where I started, but then I really got into fusion. Like, Return to Forever, I've seen them in concert twice, and I remember the first time I saw them, it really got me into fusion playing, because I hadn't heard much music like that. I liked jam bands and stuff in the past, and I was like, this is like a jam band, but they're all really, really good. I want to play like that.
A jam band that doesn't suck.
Exactly. So I kind of, that kind of segued me into progressive metal, because, you know, bands like Return to Forever, that kind of heavy fusion, aren't that far removed from prog. It's kind of like, okay, through compose it more, add some heavier guitars, and there you go. I'll give you a little background, I guess, how I got into playing metal. When I was at Berkeley, I think it was my second semester, I was kind of a funk fusion player, and I had a neighbor in the dorms who was more of a metal player. His name's Cameron Rasmussen, and he came over. He was like, hey, do you want to start a funk metal band? And I was like, okay, I've never played metal before. I don't really listen to it. This sounds interesting. And the rest is kind of history from there. So came to really love the progressive style. And that band was called Sound Struggle, by the way.
Yeah, actually, the right-hand work in funk, if you just put it on one string and palm mute it,
yeah,
so it's basically metal. Those of you on Riff Hard know Carter Arrington from our one-on-ones, but, like, my friend Carter is, like, a funk fucking master. And so I grew up watching him play it and be like, this is the most insane right-hand work I've ever seen, but I don't like this kind of music.
That's fair. You're afraid of the natural six, huh?
No, I don't mind that. I don't mind that. There's the feels too happy. Like, yeah, if music doesn't make me feel like there's, like, blood dripping down my face or something, I'm just not into it.
Man, well, you're going to hate us.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you guys are definitely not dark, but that's okay. You should do what music comes to you naturally.
Just listen to our song, yeah. Muckduck.
We can't all do black metal and, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think we try to be, like, happy, you know. Let's write a happy song, but it's just, like, something that happens.
I don't think you guys come off as happy. You just don't. You're just not dark. It's party music.
Yes,
the lack of distortion.
Though Mr. Bungle used funk, I don't think you could say their stuff is happy at all. It's, like, some of the most twisted stuff out there. So there's ways to use funk. But, yeah, like, I think that there's nothing worse than when you can tell that a band is trying to be something that they're not. I mean, there are things worse than that. But it's very off-putting, I think. And I think that music listeners can smell it the way that drug dogs can find your fentanyl stash.
Especially, like, the metal, prog metal world. People seem to catch on.
Yeah, you got to do what comes naturally to you. So I think that that's really the most important thing. But I always find it interesting when people come to music from a standpoint that I personally kind of don't get, like, because I would never come up with that. So it's interesting for me to know how they came to that, like, what about it they like. I don't mean in a condescending way, like, I'm actually totally curious about that. So that's why it's interesting to know, okay, so you didn't come from a metal background.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's all coming clear to me.
Sure.
What was it about it that made you want to play it?
Really just the raw energy. You know, fusion and stuff, like, Return to Forever is a great band, but it certainly doesn't have the kind of energy that, you know, a soaring prog band would have. And just, like, the guitar riffs that I wasn't really accustomed to. They're a lot of fun to play, challenging leads as well. But I'd say, yeah, overall, it's just the raw energy and the excitement that you get when listening to a really, you know, high-octane metal song or riff. It's just the power. Mo power.
Yeah, definitely drawn to that aspect as a kid, too. There's just, and then once you get a taste of it, like, oh, here we go. Mm-hmm. Down the rabbit hole we go.
Drink it up.
So I want to hear more about this alternate picking workaround situation, because not alternate picking in this style of music is kind of hard to get around it. So I want to hear more about that.
It's definitely a challenge. Well, maybe not so much for me, because it kind of, alternate picking does not come naturally to me. So if I was like, okay, I'm going to try to alternate pick a lot in this solo.
So what comes naturally? Disaster.
Legato and hybrid picking, basically just mixing those two techniques together. The legato gives me the speed. If you mute a little bit, it almost sounds like you're picking. And the hybrid picking allows me to string skip pretty easily without moving my hand vertically. And that's kind of what I use to make my life easier. And maybe it's good that I utilize those techniques, because playing some of these riffs that like Joey will write, our song Stella, that first part, the like first head, it's really fast. And on guitar, it doesn't make sense, because it's a piano part. So using, you know, a lot of hybrid picking allowed me to get a lot of those weird intervals that Joey plays that, I mean, I couldn't dream of doing alternate picking. There are people that can do it, of course. But yeah, that's kind of how I've had to adapt to this style of music without alternate picking.
I want to hear more about how you get the tone right for a riff when you're hybrid picking, because lots of the time I hear players talking about incorporating hybrid picking into solos more than anything, but you don't hear about it too often for riffs. And I'm wondering, yeah, how do you get the tone right, and how you make sure that it doesn't sound weak?
Yeah, if it would be like a riff, I will say like a lot of our riffs, if I'm just playing straight up rhythms, will be just picked or chugged. But yeah, the hybrid picking parts that I use, I guess I just try to pull up more and get more of a snappy tone, get that percussiveness. Because, yeah, I do agree, it could be challenging if you're just hybrid picking like you would playing a solo, because I try to get a nice even tone, but on the lower strings with a lot of distortion, it would lose that aggressiveness. So I'd say just, yeah, really trying to get a percussiveness out of plucking much harder than I would otherwise is kind of how I do that. When I'm soloing, I try to have a nice even tone between my legato and hybrid picking. I don't want a ton of separation there. I don't want people to say, oh, he, you know, hybrid picked that note like chicken picking style. That's not really what I go for too much. Yeah, but with riffs, it's definitely more aggressive.
I noticed like the tone kind of, you have to like calibrate your fingers to the tone, and if that makes sense that you're playing. Like if it's like a high gain tone and mid gain tone, I'll actually be like playing and seeing like what intensity needs to happen to make the desired sound come out. That's different for like if you're doing a high gain solo and you're hybriding than like a clean fusion tone, right? I'd imagine for you, Adam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then like using compression and stuff. There's some like there's a song Earthshine. At least the patch I have is like really compressed, so that it really exaggerates that hybrid pluck sound.
So you use your rig to help.
It definitely does. It's good to practice acoustically to make sure you're actually like doing things correctly. But
no, yeah, but like, I mean, people use delay to help their solos sound good. Like, should use the tools available to you. Yeah, so it makes sense that if you need a more even sort of output, basically compress the signal going in, for sure. It works. I mean, that's also a really good hack. In your case, it sounds like it's like really great players using it to make it even more appropriate tone wise. But like also the use of compression or limiting or whatever is one of the tricks that you can use when you record a solo and the player is going back and forth between legato, alternate picking, sweeping, tapping, all that stuff. And there's vastly different volumes on all of them. Like they'll go into legato and it's like barely picking up any signal, and then they alternate pick and it's basically clipping. Limiting the DI is a good way to get around that.
Oh, I haven't tried that.
It works really, really well.
I will say though that our keyboard player, I was definitely like listening to like his tone he'll use in certain passages. Like he has the ability to like curve his velocities, like almost like an E-kit, how you can tell like the drums to be like max velocity when you hit, you know. He can do that with certain patches, so like everything is 127 for like an intense riff. So I'll hear that and I'll be like, I want to like match that. Like, I know it's like borderline and we can't be 127 with every hit, but it's definitely like something I want. Like if he didn't do that, maybe I wouldn't think about it as much. Like the sound definitely triggers something for me to be like, how do I get as close to that as possible, so we sound like we're working together and there's not like notes occasionally popping out and then just falling back.
It's one of those things where I think it's not just like you put compression on and it sounds great. You have to know how to set it. You have to set it exactly right for what you're going to be doing. It definitely is kind of a life changer when it comes to dealing with DIs.
Interesting.
Getting them as even as you need for this kind of music.
Yeah, I've actually never compressed my DIs. I'm a simple man.
You just do that raw practice.
But I'll have to give that a go.
Yeah, there's that method too.
I just play it 5,000 times until I'm satisfied, I guess.
It's like when drummers don't know triggers exist, so they practice to be even.
Oh, yeah.
Let me clarify something. Limiting or compressing a DI, like, there's a use for that when you're trying to rescue something that's horribly played. But in the context that we're talking about here, like, the player has to already be like 90% there or totally like in the ballpark for what the desired outcome is. And then the, you know, the compression or the limiting is the same thing as making the right amp choice. It's just you choose the right gear, or you create the right patch or whatever, to help achieve the outcome. But if the playing's not there, it doesn't matter. So I wanted to clarify that this is all within the, under the umbrella of, you have to play it the right way in order for the effect or the processing to do the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, compression evens out everything, including your mistakes.
Yes, exactly.
Noise control, muting, all those things. I think the like insane mode in line 6 actually helped with that too. It's like so noisy that I'd be like, I just accepted that's how all amps are. They're just so noisy. And so I'd just be like, I'd be playing as controlled and noiseless as I can, especially if I like mic'd it or whatever and went through some like garage band thing. I'd be like, all right, reduce noise. And then I didn't, gates were discovered, or for me anyway. I was like, oh, okay. Do you think there's things that can help? That's awesome.
Let's talk about what you did to reduce noise before you discard gates.
It was really just attentiveness of left and right hand and like when they have the opportunity to mute. And yeah, it was just, and then I guess using like the flesh of like the end of your right hand to like be strategically muting the strings you're not playing. I mean, I'd play a lot of like metal stuff, so it'd be like drop tuning all the wound strings, you know, playing chords there. So I'd be like constantly building the habit of muting the unwound strings, so you reduce the noise there. And then like if you're fretting with like just a couple of fingers, you use the rest of your fingers on your left hand, you know, to just mute out everything else. And just that partnership with the two hands slowly became this habit.
We just had Rich Shaw from Cradle of Filth on Riff Hard, and he has a whole section on that, on muting properly. It's so, so important, because so many people just think of muting as like palm muting, but they don't think of it as something that involves both hands and is more, it's more about control of the things that will get in the way than actually creating a tone. It's more about like a harm reduction. But I do think that there's a place in the studio for muting your guitar with, you know, tape and all that stuff in order to get rid of, especially things that you can't mute with your hands, like the springs vibrating. Anyone who's recorded a DI with springs that are ringing knows what that pain is like to try to deal with. So that, and you know, the other noisemakers, it does help to do what you can about those. And also, you know, muting strings that you're not using, just if you're, you know, recording a single string riff or something like that. But again, it's like if the player isn't good and isn't already good at muting, there's only so far that those things are going to go. Like, it's still not going to sound great. Like, it can help a shitty player sound less terrible, but it's not going to make someone sound great. The only thing that's going to make someone sound great is how they play something.
Yeah, but ultimately, I mean, you got to do it live anyway. So, yeah, like, if I'm tracking just a tapping part that I need to get, like, pristine so it cuts through the mix, sure, I might, like, mute some of the strings, but if I can't do it live and it sounds like shit, what's the point? That's the ultimate goal, at least for us. So yeah, I have no problem with that either. No shame.
Yeah, it's always gonna be live with us. So everything we write, it's like, well, be ready to suffer the consequences.
Yeah,
of the part that you write or the arrangement you make.
I think it's interesting hearing the shitty original demos from people that went on to get better. I like to hear those and then compare them against the shitty demos I hear now. You know, because when you hear a really, really bad demo, obviously you're going to think it sucks. But at the same time, you got to remember that everybody sucked at some point. So it's interesting to me to hear those things from players that got good. So to hear if I can tell that they're going to get good. And oftentimes you can tell that they're going to get good. Like there's something about it that is still better than just a shitty demo, but like they don't have everything figured out. And it doesn't totally suck, or you can tell that there's some talent there from what I've noticed.
That makes sense for sure. I'd have to revisit. Now I'm curious. I think focusing on the performance aspect was super important because it was more about like tweaking tones at that point. So I'd always try to be like, everything's in time. I wasn't savvy at editing guitars yet. So I would be constantly just getting that, just re-recording the whole passage and just trying to nail it. And then I'll try to mix it after that and be like, okay. And then I just realized I'm horrible at dialing in amps. Okay, let's work on that, you know? So it's cool to like tackle like one aspect of it at a time. Cause sometimes if you just like do this whole thing and you're like, what's wrong with this production or mix? There could be so many variables that could be, you know, attributing to that. So it definitely helped for me.
Well, yeah, if the playing is great and the tone is great in the hands and it still sounds like shit, then you know that it's you as an engineer, basically, fucking it up.
For sure. Touching on what you said about hearing someone's demo today, like it's impossible not to be like humbled by like listening to your own crappy original demo. So like I've always been like not very judgmental when I hear someone. In fact, I think people's demos are like better. The gear's gotten better for sure, but it's just I think people's attentiveness. I mean, I don't go like scouring the internet for demos, but I'll just hear someone like post a thing on a forum randomly, like, oh, like first or second attempt at a thing. I'm like, this is like years ahead of like something I've done. Like the ear for detail and stuff. So I'll see a lot of cool stuff happening with these like beginners or up and comers or whatever.
I was just going to say, it's probably a lot of the like flow of information these days, just between people on social media, for example. It's not like these kind of deep in the internet forums talking about mixing. It's like way more of an open discussion. So maybe that's helped to accelerate a lot of people's knowledge and abilities.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the internet has definitely helped people get better. And I definitely think that the bar has been raised for musicianship, for sure. Back to the hybrid picking thing. Like, it seems to me like hybrid picking is just now something that metal players that want to get good do. Like, I just think that that's part of the repertoire now is hybrid picking. And it wasn't for the longest time. I think this is like a relatively new thing that is just something metal players learn how to do. But it's a perfect example because the bar is constantly getting raised.
Yeah, it's like a lot of these new techniques, you know, that Tosin's introducing as well. It's like, it's not just about alternate picking anymore. And a lot of, like the progressive genre, at least, a lot of people are getting quite into fusion. Like it's moving that way for a lot of bands. So kind of helps players like me. So it's like, oh, I can hybrid pick and be in a metal band. Thank God. Yeah.
Yeah. It's validation.
Yeah.
Do you feel like lots of players rely too much on the low strings and don't use the full range of their guitars?
Yeah, I think depending on the style, you could say that.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. It depends on what you're going for, because like picking hard on the low strings, there's an aggression to that. That's for certain genres, it's super necessary. And the song itself may not necessitate some sort of upper range thing. But I mean, we like to utilize a lot of the strings for sure. That's just our specific taste.
And just using different like chord inversions, like instead of just making it a power chord, you know, you could use first inversion on the top four strings or something and get just like a different sound that might blend better with the keyboards or anything, for example. People could experiment maybe a little more with different versions of chords. I think it's an interesting sound you can get.
That and also not playing like the key of your song shouldn't be what the zero is on your lowest string on the all the time.
As tempting,
I mean, it can
it
be, but like don't do it on every song. You know, like if you're an A, maybe write in C sharp. Now your flat six is the zero, or that's how I look at it. Or
it's hard to think about that when writing metal, just because that low string is such a part of the style. But I agree, it's an important thing to learn how to do. it's tough for people, I think, to wrap their heads around that is because of the way that they write on the instrument.
Yeah. A big thing is if the guitarist is feeling like they are missing something or they want to expand in some way, they feel that conflict. If they're very content with what they're doing, then, you know, then there's no problem. But if someone's like, I want to like expand what I'm doing, I'm like, then like kind of think about like what Adam just said about chord voicings. And also like, are you playing the zero like a lot? Or you can play the zero, but is the zero serving as like the fourth in the scale, the flat six in the scale, or the flat seventh?
Well, I think because so much metal is written on the instrument and not in people's heads. So much metal is written by just playing it and coming up with something cool while playing that it kind of, the way that the guitar sounds best or sounds easiest for the style tends to be how the style is written. Whereas there's other styles of music where people write, you know, on a keyboard and then arrange it, or they write it in their heads. Metal is oftentimes written sitting there playing guitar. And so people's tendencies tend to, it's like they get in the way of, it's almost like they both help reinforce something, but they also get in the way of getting past your tendencies. And what is the tendency for a metal player is to play open strings. So,
yeah, there's some like raw, like you were saying, Adam, with raw energy in metal. There's something like raw and visceral about like just playing those. There's an aggression to it that like it's hard to top.
Just whamming.
The temptation is always going to be there, like probably forever for me to be like, oh, just play a big meaty like open A chord. But now we look at it almost as like a, we'll look at breakdowns, for example, even as like a reward for our. Like, okay, we actually like wrote a bunch of things. Let's reward ourselves by writing something like
just shameless.
Shameless and heavy and just not worrying about the harmony. It's more just like pick something filthy on the guitar and let's just like orchestrate around it. And it's just fun.
Yeah, we made people listen to our up its own ass, you know, notiness. Now, you know, kill each other.
Yeah,
basically.
If people actually write stuff where there's a payoff, it's always a benefit. I think one of the things that makes metal boring is that it can be a constant payoff, which makes it no payoff.
Mm-hmm. Like the whole song's a breakdown?
Yes.
A band that popped in my head when you said that was Alpha Wolf, but it's like they make their songs relatively shorter. They're not writing like 6-minute prog songs. So it's like, it's great like energy, and it lasts like I think the perfect amount of time to like fit that sort of vibe. So, but if it went on for much longer, I think, but there's an awareness of that. I think they're, whoever's writing or producing, they're aware of like, okay, how long can we get away with this? So there's a strategy to it.
How long is this interesting for?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. 6 minutes of that would be a little rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Must be interesting designing a live set.
Yeah, for sure.
You don't want to ADD too much and not let an idea sink in, but also how much is too much repetition? It's kind of tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like melody, like repeating itself almost like a vocal would, that repetition's important, but like how many times should that happen? And there's always, I mean, it feels like it can be calculated, but sometimes I'll notice with us, it's like trial and error as well. You can like kind of maybe predict what might work and then.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Opeth.
Record it. Yeah. And there's Opeth.
Yeah.
But yeah, just like embellishing upon those.
Well, no, they'll play the same thing over and over and over again for like 2 minutes straight, and it's still awesome. I wouldn't have the balls to do that.
It's almost like a fear of doing that for me. Me personally.
Same.
Playing, vamping. I'm like, are people going to hate that?
What are we, a jam band?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good place to end the episode. I want to thank both of you for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Anytime.
Really interesting, thought-provoking discussion, so.